offering our most humble pranams at Bhagavan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's afternoon satsang. This is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Arvind, and we are coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. As we always do, it is this fortnight in which we dwell on the beautiful name and the lovely story of Lord Sri Rama. So as always, before we begin, let us start by ruminating over the wonderful name of the Lord.
Shri Raghavam Dasharatatmajama Prame Sitapatim Raghukulanmaya Ratnadipam Ajanubahum Aravindadalayataksham Ramam Nishachara Vinashakaram Namami
Sai Ram, dear listeners, we begin by offering our most humble salutations at the lotus feet of our dear Swami and of Lord Sri Hanuman, who is present always, wherever and whenever the glory of his Lord Ram is sung. We seek to derive inspiration to become like dear Hanuman for our dear Sai Ram. I am Arvind from Team Radio Sai, and yes, Sai Ram Prem, it's a pleasure to again delve on this beautiful name of Sri Rama. Even as, you know, this shloka was being played, Sri Raghavam, I was just thinking that there's one phrase there, you know, Nishachara Vinashakaram. It means Lord Sri Rama is the one who destroys the Nishacharas. And Nishachara, in the direct sense, it means the demons, the Rakshasas. And we know that Lord Sri Rama did that throughout his sojourn on earth, where he killed innumerable demons and Rakshasas. But if we break up the word Nishachara, Nisha means night, and Nishachara means one who roams about in the night. The Rakshasas, they say, gain all their strength at night, and that is when they roam about. But if we go a little deeper, we realize that when they say night, the darkness being referred to there is the darkness of ignorance, Ajnana Timirandhasya, as they say in that shloka, you know. It is the darkness of ignorance. And so, Lord Sri Rama is the one who brings the light of wisdom, the light of atmic wisdom to all of us and illumines us. And in that sense also, he is the Nishachara Vinashakaram. That is one who destroys those who are, you know, roaming in the darkness, in the sense of Rakshasas, also in terms of conferring wisdom and light. That becomes more evident as we go through the Ramakatha Rasavahini, because we can see the Ramayana at different levels, at the physical level, at the mental level, at the metaphysical level, at the spiritual level, the Adhyatma Ramayana, the normal, you know, the story Ramayana. So therefore, it is a beautiful experience every fortnight. And it is indeed a privilege and pleasure for all of us to be able to partake of this beautiful nectarous story, the Ramakatha Rasavahini.
Very true. And even as we are going through this, as we have mentioned this before, the story of Ramayana is not new to us, especially being children brought up in India. We've really, it's been part of our staple diet, Ramayana and Mahabharata. But even having said that, when you keenly look at the story, when you really with magnifying glasses go through the story as written by Swami, one thing is of course the unmissable parallels that you can see between Swami's life and the story of Ramayana. But at the same time, it also gives you a beautiful perspective, because oftentimes the question is asked is, you know, if really the Lord can come in a human form, would he keep his activities confined to one kingdom, one land, or one, you know, one set of people? Shouldn't his work be global? Shouldn't his work be in such a manner that everybody in the entire world recognizes him as an embodiment of divinity? Because that's also a question which many people ask about Swami. Because someone was telling, I think you were telling, right, when you went to the passport office, they asked you who is, you know, who is Satya Sai Baba?
And that's in Hyderabad. And
that's in Hyderabad, which is like the capital of the state and which Puttaparthi is in. You know, that is the thing which sometimes is striking. People ask that if he is really God as you claim him to be, then how is he not a global phenomenon, though he is one? But as you said, there can be cases of darkness being right at the feet of the candle itself. So one wonders if he is really a divine incarnate, and we all know that God is one. So why isn't he a phenomenon which is like, you know, one day why can't he appear on the sky and everybody can see him and recognize and honor him as the God we all pray to? But when you go through the Ramayana, that's the striking feature of the thing. In fact, not only Ramayana, be it, you know, the Krishna avatar or the other avatars, if you even just look at the Hindu tradition, the Sanatana Dharma tradition, the 10 avatars, all the avatars, their effect when they were there was always only local. You know, their effect of that avatar, of that incarnation has always been local, but the impact has been global. What has happened after that incarnation, the impact has always been global. And we can give many explanations for that, but I think that is the way it is. You know, all explanations are trying to understand why God did it that way, but this is how he has always done it. So if we have the doubt about Swami, like if he's really God, if he's really divine, why wasn't this, why wasn't he known globally? I think this is how it has been throughout.
Exactly. Who knew about, maybe Krishna had some kind of a little, not global, but a nationwide at least, in the Indian subcontinent, he was known in different kingdoms. Yeah, Rama even less, and the avatars before,
yeah,
even
what
less.
About even Vamana or somebody like, you know, I think nobody would have known. In fact, even we, as people who have accepted Vamana as an avatar, I don't think we know the story of Vamana before he came into the court of Bali.
Exactly.
You know, we know the avatar only from when he steps into the court and he does that beautiful act.
I did not know the details of Vamana avatar till I came to Sai's Darbar. It is thanks to Swami that I got to know Vamana's story. You know, it takes me on a slightly divergent note, Prem, but all the same, I feel it's important that we stress it now. The need for these stories to be told, you know, some people say, you know, after all, it's mythology. Why? It's fiction. But do you want your child to grow up with this kind of fiction? Or with, you know, whatever the latest cartoons, I don't even know, Pokemon. Do you want your child to grow up with Pokemon? Yes, Pokemon is fiction, Ramayana is fiction. But what does Ramayana imbibe? What does Ramayana imbibe in us? You know, Prem, I feel we are, in a sense, lucky. Possibly we are the last generation to have had the privilege of being schooled into the Ramayana and Mahabharata, even as we were children by our grandparents. Today, forget Ramayana, Mahabharata. I don't know if many children have the privilege of knowing their grandparents as well, because this is an age of highly nuclear families and families splitting even before they become families. So, in such an age, so grandparents themselves are a distant dream. There are specialized old age homes where you can invest in and you can go and start living your life there. But coming back to the point, so no longer are these stories told, and when asked, everybody justifies it by just saying that, you know, after all, it's mythology and no problem. I mean, I see it in the Indian variant of that Who Wants to Be a Millionaire program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, complex questions, the nuances of some song in a movie, people know it. But you ask whether Sita is Rama's wife or Lakshmana's wife, and people want helplines. They want to ask the crowd, or they want to use an helpline option to get the answer. And they say, after all, it's a fiction story, so how does it matter? But this fiction story has inspired generations after generations. And this is what I can say with conviction, based on my own life experience of what I have seen little, and based on what Swami has said. Just bring up two children, one on Pokemon diet, one on the Ramayana diet. And within 10 years, you will see not a world, but a cosmos of difference between the two children. Because that is why it is said it is the Adhyatma Ramayana. Unknown to us, at an age when children just accept. You know, recently I met two children. And for them, Pokemon is as real as the elephant in the zoo. I mean, they have no doubts about it. So you want them to have faith in something like a Pokemon cartoon? I'm just using Pokemon as one sample because it's one of the most popular cartoons. Wouldn't you want them to have like that in Rama? In the ideal that Rama stood for? Because though Rama might be, even if you consider Rama as a mythical character, which Sai devotees, I'm sure, and those who follow Swami will know it is not, because Swami has stressed that Rama has existed. If you consider, let us say you consider Ramayana or even the Mahabharata as a mythical, mythological story.
Mm-hmm.
But what lessons it teaches. What phenomenal lessons. Why Swami would therefore say, why do you teach Baba black sheep? And Swami would say, ba ba black sheep. You don't even teach them about the white sheep. You teach them about black sheep. Instead of them, why don't you teach them shlokas, Veda mantras? Why don't you teach them stories of the Lord, which are so inspiring? And therefore, I feel it is great importance that as adults or as parents or as grandparents, we teach our children this. But to teach our children this, you know, Prem, what is a requisite? We ourselves should know the story at least. So in the multiple multimedia that the world is throwing to us, let us not get lost and forget these beautiful stories. In the worst case scenario, they are beautiful stories with phenomenal insights and great idealism. And in the best case scenario, this is the history of the universe. So in either case, it makes a lot of sense that we read it and we propagate it and teach it to our children as well.
And sometime back, I was listening to an interview.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, not an interview, it's a talk by a devotee from the United States. He has a very interesting story. He's a very interesting person too. I'm sure that was one of the most unique talks on Swami I ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think his name is, if I've not got it wrong, it's Michael McCartney.
Okay,
he's an African-American.
Huh.
Very interesting story, his story itself. You know, he comes as for a profession, for the world, he does acupuncture or something like that.
Okay.
But openly he says that he was a drug peddler.
Hmm.
And that's how he comes to Swami. And he says that just a couple of glimpses of spiritual experiences that he has with Swami, he realizes that what spirituality can give, even the best of drugs cannot give you. Because he says, I got the, you know, the feeling of high and the feeling of being at peace at yourself and being, you know, in a state of tranquility. He said, when you can get it by taking the Amritam which comes out of Swami's picture, I felt that I don't need these things anymore.
And you know, he says, that they say in the Sanskrit term for wine and liquor is somarasa.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami says, when you have Ramarasa, who will want the somarasa?
Absolutely. That's exactly what his case. And he says, the relevance of bringing him up in this discussion is, eventually he becomes a professional storyteller.
Hmm.
So he does nothing but tell stories. So in this talk, at the end of it, they ask him that, why did you become a storyteller? What is so special about telling stories?
Hmm.
He says, because we don't realize the culture of every community is actually encapsulated in their stories. And much more is passed on to the other generation through stories than by telling them what the culture and customs are.
Hmm.
And if you look at it, you know, many times when watching the TV or watching a movie, I feel this, you know, you have a scene where the son wants to marry a particular person. The father says no. And it's like the biggest, you know, hurdle in your, in that situation. But looking at it from an absolutely modern perspective, what is the problem? Here's an individual wanting to do something. How can another individual say no to it? Mm. It's his or his or her life. But viewing it from our cultural perspective, we feel that yes, I mean, that's the climactical situation there.
Mm.
I think that is what has been passed through stories like Ramayana and Mahabharata. You know, over and over again, no amount of explanations can sway Lord Rama away from this choice that he has made, because he's saying that my father has told me. This is a word which my father has given, and it's my bounden duty to follow it. It might be the most ideal situation, but this has been presented to us in a form of a story. So in the back of our mind, we know that obedience to our parents is like part of the fabric of this culture. You know, we may deviate from it based on, you know, how good or how obedient we are, but we know that this is the standard. I think that's what happens when these stories are passed on from generation to generation.
Exactly, Prem. You know, the problem is nowadays we want obedience to parents. But I don't care for the Ramayana. Why? Why should I care about the Ramayana? I mean, I want the benefits of that, but I, you know, take great pleasure and pride in putting it down. In the name of science maybe, in whatever be the logical rationale behind me putting it down or not giving it importance, I will definitely want all the benefits that such a story can bring. And I would love a son as ideal as Rama. I would love a daughter as ideal as Sita. And that is what Swami used to say. People would say, I forget the Telugu, in that Rama vanti bidda kavalani Sita, Sita vanti. You know, in the Telugu song that Swami sings, he says that everyone says that we want a son like Rama. We want a daughter like Sita. So everybody wants that. So I feel children become what they are exposed to. If we want them to be like Rama, we have to expose them to Rama. Not to video games, war, terror and other kind of sensual things. So especially children, because children are so impressionable. And so dear listeners, after this kind of an elaborate introduction, which I'm sure neither Prem or I had planned it, we now reach that part of the Ramayana story where the entire Ayodhya, especially the youth, you know, that is the ideal youth, the youth who run behind God, and that is what was happening at Ayodhya. The entire youth from the town of Ayodhya, from the city of Ayodhya, were following the chariot which was being driven by Sumantra with Lakshmana, Rama and Sita on board, and they're all following and telling Rama, take us with you, take us with you. We want to come with you because there's no life without you. At that time, you know, Rama tries telling them, he says, see, your parents are aged at home and they need your support. It's not right that all the youth of the kingdom leave and come like this. So go back and serve your parents. See the beauty of this. What Rama says is also right. What the youth says is also right. The youth then say that, Rama, our parents are saying that because of their age, they are not able to run behind the chariot. They are bemoaning their fate that they don't have the strength in their legs to run behind your chariot. So they have told us that, go children, what we are not able to do, you do it. And they are the ones who have told us to come behind you. So therefore, Rama, you can't tell us to turn back. And even Rama is dumbstruck. As Swami writes, Rama is also dumbstruck. He is just moved. And Rama feels that the sacrifice that I am making by giving up my kingdom for the sake of my father's word pales into insignificance at the sacrifice that the youth of this kingdom are making. It's so, so beautiful. Because I remember with many students, Swami would say the same thing. He would say, no, no, don't stay with Swami, go. Your parents have the desire, your parents wish, you find out what your parents wishes, do what they say. And then the student would say, Swami, my parents want me to be with you and do what you say, Swami. So therefore nothing, you know, you can't bring the parents in picture to use them as an obstruction between you and me. And in such instances, many times, Swami too would be dumbstruck and tongue-tied and he would have nothing to say. So such a beautiful scene it is that happens. And so Rama is trying to convince the youth to go back, but the youth are saying, no, this is our parents' desire, and since we worship our parents, we want to be with you.
Absolutely. No, that's what they say. They said, if they were able-bodied like us, they would have followed too.
Mm.
And since they were not able to follow, they kind of pleaded with us to, you know, take on this. Again, it's such a beautiful thing. I mean, these are the subtleties of the story. you know, we all know the Ramayana, we all know that, you know, he had four sons and they were married to these four princesses and Ravana was killed. I mean, that story is known, but these are the things which actually carry that culture forward in the form of a story. And the role parents play, I mean, it's so subtle. The acknowledgement which comes from Lord Rama also, you know, this is a sacrifice which is far greater than mine, because I am bound, you know, by the word of my father, and of course there is that hidden mission which is there, which I'm following, and I know exactly what I'm doing. You know, as an avatar, he has the full knowledge of the whole play. But in, you know, thrown into ignorance, when you don't know what is coming in front, you don't know that Rama is going to turn you back away, you don't know that, you know, this is not going to be your future, but still at that moment, when you don't know what is in front of you, you still make that choice of choosing God over the other things. I think these are the very beautiful things. I think sometime, just today, yesterday, I was listening to a story.
Mm-hmm.
I think it just has to come here, about how the role parents play in bringing up children. This was about an IAS officer who's mm-hmm. currently serving, about a 44-year-old. A very upright and very humble officer, given his immense knowledge. So when somebody was asking him, like, how are you so grounded? You know, because you're so knowledgeable, you're in a position of power. How are you so grounded and you're so, you know, strong in your values? So he said, see, that is the upbringing one goes through when he lives in the villages and the small towns of this country. And he described a scene which he saw, which was so heartwarming. You know, it seems he was in one particular small town. He was traveling. This was when he was a student. And he found that there was a small mob which was vandalizing a few shops.
Okay.
Apparently some riots had broken out. And a group of mobsters were just going and ransacking some of the shops in that area. And they were even breaking into shops and taking away TVs and, you know, huge electronic gadgets. So he saw that in that group, there was a small boy. Okay, and this boy forgot about what all was happening. He just found that people are going and taking things and they're able to take it away without having to pay anything. So he said, why not I also go and grab something? But the crowd was too violent and he couldn't get into it. So finally he manages to get into one of the crockery shops and he grabs a couple of ceramic plates and jubilantly runs out of the shop. Okay. So he's also ransacked this one. So this person is very curious what this boy is doing with it. So he follows him. So he sees this boy running into not even a hut. It's about four sticks put together and there's a tarpaulin sheet which is put, and that's his house. That's how poor that boy is. So imagine he runs into that house so jubilantly that he's managed to grab these plates, ceramic plates. He runs into his mother. And, you know, this person was saying that they might not even have food to eat. And you can imagine the joy this boy had when he could lay his hands on something so exquisite like those ceramic plates. And he runs to his mother. He sees this whole scene. The mother comes out there and he explains the whole scene. He says, this is what happened and I got these plates. And you know, what is the response of the mother? The mother says, are you my child? Were you born to me? And she says, how dare you do something like this? Mm. And she looks up into the heavens and she says, God, what sin have I done that my son has done this today? And this boy is like aghast. He's saying he's not able to make any sense of it. And just then the father comes out. The mother describes the whole scene. She says, this is what this boy has done. Then the father looks at him and says, as long as you can even put your hands together, you beg and eat, but never do this. And he says, take it away. Don't even bring it into the house. So he says, you know, these are the values which, you know, such values in the depths of poverty, this is what really stands for our culture.
This is what enriches us, actually.
Absolutely. And I think these are the things, you know, when you see, it is not just the fatherly love that Dashrata had for Rama or the kind of dedication Rama had for his father. But in every small character, this is there. You know, this is even in the small stories, in the bylines of the Ramayana, you can find these values enshrined.
You know, I remember my own mother, Prem. When I was in grade 11, when I got the chance to join Swami's school, I remember her very clearly, distinctly. She called me aside and she said, see Arvind, from today onwards, it's not that you're not my son, but you belong to Swami more than you belong to me. It's just that Swami had given you to me. So you were like my son for some time. But it's not that I'm disowning you, but you belong to Swami. So I said, okay. So she said, so therefore, in future, if I express any desire to you and tell you, Arvind, do this or do that, please promise me that you will remind me saying that, Amma, Mother, you have given me to Swami, so therefore my first priority is Swami, and I will do what Swami says. And if at all, you know, my mother told me that if at all what Swami has told you is coming in conflict with what I have told you, don't even think for a second, just discard what I have told you and listen to what Swami has said. And I feel, Prem, that at that point there was nothing logical. I just got very moved and I said, Mother, what is this you are speaking? She also had tears in her eyes. She said, no, this is what I wanted to promise me. Will you promise me this? And I said, okay. Sometimes I feel after that, when, you know, people say that, wow, your dedication to Swami or your devotion to Swami, I feel it was not something that I inculcated consciously by putting efforts. It's just that my love towards my mother, and it's a mixture of so many things, and I feel it just happened. And see, these are the things that happen when parents inculcate it in children. It just comes off naturally, and it's not as if you have to put in effort and you have to inculcate it. I really don't think that I have done something that ensures that I have a dedication or a devotion to Swami. I really don't know. I don't remember putting any effort to get devotion or dedication to Swami, but I'm sure all these have contributed. That's why many times when people say, you know, you have been so blessed, I feel, you know, that blessing is because of my mother. Because she pushed me towards Swami. And it's just, that is why I was reminded of my mother when I saw this example, because I literally felt that she was feeling that I could not get a chance to be Swami's student, so let my son get the chance. Just as these denizens of Ayodhya were telling their children that, you know, we are not able to run behind Rama, so you run behind Rama. In Swami's case, that was literally true. The devotees are not able to run not only because of age, but because of rules. You are not able to run behind Swami. But students had that privilege. So I literally felt that that is what my parents did, and I am very, very, very grateful to them for that. Because today I see, it's not that logically I accepted and I have gained. Without any logic or whatever, just out of reverence and faith in what they say, I have led my life that way, and today I am seeing the benefits are so immense, and now I am seeing the benefit even logically. I am convinced that this is the way to live. So that is the importance of parents imbibing in children and children listening to their parents, and all this happens when we propagate culture through such ennobling stories.
And Naveen, even as you were describing about the promise your mother asked me, I'm just wondering whether we skipped one very important episode when the three of them leave Ayodhya.
Okay.
The episode with Urmila and Lakshmana. I don't know whether we narrated it.
Yes,
I think it's
right,
because it is one of the highlight episodes which Swami would speak of much later. And stories about some of the characters which are not much spoken about in other Ramayanas. And Swami would speak of this so many times, I think in the later summer courses, 2000, 2001 and the following ones. Swami spoke so much about it, where he said, you know, he spoke about the characters who were not much spoken about, like Urmila, Mandodari and the likes. Where he says that when Lakshmana decides that he is going to go along with Rama, Rama tells Lakshmana that you take the permission of your mother and your wife.
Exactly. And you know, this is very important. I don't know how we forgot it. But I think I can reason out why we forgot it. We are so strictly following the Ramkatha Rasavahini.
Right, exactly.
And in the Ramkatha Rasavahini, Swami has not mentioned about it. It's only in the summer course that Swami has mentioned. Dear listeners, this is very, very important, and we will be coming to that part. We will just be taking a flashback, and we will come to this part of the beautiful scene of how Lakshmana takes his leave from Urmila, what Urmila tells Lakshmana, what Sumitra, the mother of Lakshmana, tells Lakshmana. All this coming to you right after this little break. So don't go anywhere, stay tuned, enjoy this little break, and a beautiful story coming up after that.
Rama, 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 Sita, Rama, 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 Sita. Sita Devi ni preeti varinchi, premana hari.
So rewinding our story, you know, we spoke about how Rama takes the blessings from his mother Kausalya, and he informs the other mothers. Now Lakshmana, he has been permitted by Rama to accompany him, and Lakshmana too goes to his mother, and it's so beautiful. Swami says that Sumitra, her name itself suggests, Sumitra means a good friend. She is a true friend because she is an epitome of selflessness. And when Lakshmana goes, she is more than happy. She just blesses her son and says that it's indeed a privilege that you're getting to serve Rama. And she elicits a promise from Lakshmana saying that the way you would serve me, in the same manner you serve the Lord, serve Rama. And Sumitra, Swami says, was so joyful and joyous that both her sons got the privilege of serving their elder brothers. That is, Shatrughna, as we shall see later on, stayed back and served Bharata. In fact, it was Shatrughna who ruled the empire of Ayodhya, because
right,
we'll see how Bharata went off to Nandigrama and became a recluse. So it was Shatrughna who ruled Ayodhya, and Lakshmana who served Rama throughout the exile. And you know, it just brings me back to one more point. In the beginning, Sumitra used to feel bad. You know, Swami had mentioned that also in a discourse, where Sumitra would feel bad that, see, Kausalya is the eldest queen, so by seniority, her son gains respect. And Kaikeyi is Dasharatha's favorite queen, and Dasharatha has also promised that her son will be made the emperor. So she also has something to look forward to. What about my children? This was the worry that Sumitra had. And how beautiful it is that Lakshmana became the most important person for Rama, and her second son, the other twin, that is Shatrughna actually ruled Ayodhya. It's not mentioned anywhere, but Sumitra's life shows us that selflessness, we actually gain more than what we give. I'm sure Sumitra would never have dreamt that it'll be her son who would, her youngest son, the youngest of the four, who would be ascending the throne in Ayodhya, and who would be, of course, on behalf of Bharata, who is doing it on behalf of Rama, but ultimately at a practical level it was Shatrughna who was the emperor and Lakshmana who was serving. And so that is what happens when Lakshmana goes to Sumitra. And then Lakshmana, of course, has to take permission from his other half, which is his wife Urmila. And Swami describes that scene also beautifully, that when he goes to his wife Urmila, she is making a painting, and she's apparently a very, very good artist and a good painter. But when Lakshmana sees the painting, he's shocked, because he says, because there's paint.
She's actually painting the scene of the Pattabhishekam. That's what Swami says, right?
Exactly. Yeah, the scene of the Pattabhishekam, meaning
coronation.
The coronation of Rama. But Lakshmana sees that there's a lot of paint splashed across the canvas, and he wonders what has happened. He says, Urmila, what is this? She says, what is so great in this painting getting ruined? The Pattabhishekam of Rama itself has got ruined. So there's nothing wrong in this painting getting ruined. And that is her way of having a creative outlet for her anguish and anger, and the fact that she's upset. She doesn't portray it in any other sense other than just ruining the own painting that she has made. You know, sometimes I feel, Prem, that if each one of us expressed our displeasure and anger in such a creative manner, the world would be much more harmonious and peaceful place to live in.
And of course, you know, the other beautiful thing that she does is, when Lakshmana goes and tells her that, no, not only Rama is going, but even Mother Sita is accompanying him, and I am going to go along with them. You know, he has permitted me to go along. And, you know, her emotion is also very surprising, because she's very, very happy. She's immensely pleased that her husband is getting this opportunity. And that's when she actually extracts a promise from Lakshmana. And she says, for the next 14 years, you should not even think of me. And Swami would speak of this and say that which wife would ask such a boon from her husband? Saying that, you know, when you're away from me, you know, any wife would say that when you go on a vacation, when you're going away on some work tour or something, you know, she would expect that you should call every day or every couple of hours. But here was a wife who was sending off her husband taking from him the promise that you should not even for once think of me in these 14 years. Because if you think of me, that might, you know, obstruct the service that you're going to render to your Lord. She says that for the next 14 years, you should not think of me, and if possible, even forget that you're married to me.
Wow, that is a...
You know, and Swami even says that she decides that she will not leave the room in which she's doing a painting till Lord Rama and Lakshmana come back 14 years later.
Wow, that is some sacrifice. I mean, it's mind-blowing, fantastic sacrifice. And an equally amazing thing is, Lakshmana is able to abide by her wishes. He actually, from that point on, actually forgets that Urmila is his wife. In fact, Lakshmana is married to the service of Rama and Sita. That is how we will see many such instances. That is how it happens. He is now in a new wedlock, sort of, because throughout we will see, throughout the exile, how Lakshmana is totally in sync with only serving Rama and Sita and no other thought. And that is what happens actually, where we had stopped the story, you know, about the youth of Ayodhya telling Rama that they don't want to go back. Rama decides that it's time to take some rest, because not that he is tired, but these people are tired. Everybody is running behind the chariot, they are tired, and if his chariot doesn't stop, they are not going to stop. So that is when Lakshmana gets his first opportunity to serve. They stop at a place, you know, there's a city that comes there on the banks of a river, on the banks of the river Tamasa.
Right.
And again, Prem, I just felt this was very symbolic. Tamas meaning sloth and darkness, it's represented by color black. So I don't think it's coincidental that at night Rama stopped at river Tamas, because the next morning when it's time for ablutions, they head towards the river Ganges later on in the journey. Mm-hmm. So it's very significant that for night they stop at river Tamas, and Rama says, let's all lie down, let's take rest. And all the citizens, they are happy and they are so fatigued that they fall asleep immediately. I was reminded of how Swami advised the students, you know, that every day is divided into three parts. One part is sattvic, one part is rajasic, one part is tamasic. The sattvic time should be used for inspirational things and for your sadhana that you do to connect with the Lord. The rajasic is the time for activity. This is when you have to do activity that sustains yourself, your family and your society. And tamasic is the resting time when you should sleep. And I remember in that discourse, it was an informal discourse, I think in Trai Brindavan, mm-hmm. Swami mentioned that 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. These 8 hours in the day are the sattvic times when one should dedicate it to one's spiritual pursuits. And if we see the hostel schedule and the mandir schedule, Prem, it's so beautiful. These are the times for the morning and evening darshans respectively, and the morning and evening prayers respectively.
Right.
And then Swami would say that morning 8 o'clock till evening 4 o'clock.
4 o'clock.
This is the rajasic time. This is when you do activities that sustain you, your family and your society. And if we see the hostel schedule, corresponding to this was the time we spend at the institute, at the university where we learn. Or if we extrapolate this to people in professional life, this is a time to work.
Right.
And then Swami would say that night 8 o'clock till next day morning 4 o'clock, these 8 hours are the tamasic time. So this is the time for rest and sleep, because it's sloth. Now we can understand how messed up sometimes we can get when we do rajasic activities during tamasic time, resulting is us in doing tamasic activities, which is sleeping in the sattvic times. You know, I sometimes feel that every morning, you know, I rise by 6:30, 6:45. Prem, I've almost wasted half of the morning sattvic time. 4 to 8 is the sattvic time. So I definitely try hard to get up earlier, if possible at least before 6 a.m. I think this is a very strong incentive, because that is the most beautiful time. And imagine Brahma Muhurtam, the most spiritual time, and we are deep in tamas. So anyway, this was the thought that I got, because Rama stops at river Tamasa and asks everyone to rest.
You know, we've all witnessed Swami giving discourses and all that. And invariably Swami's discourse would be on, of course, spiritual matters or some of these scriptural stories.
Mm.
But I remember one very unique discourse we had, something like a semi-discourse, where Swami spoke for at least half an hour to 45 minutes only about sleep the value of sleep.
Mm.
Because it was the day, on the day on which we had the Ganesh chariot procession. So the night before, almost the entire hostel had kept awake, you know, making all the chariots and all that. And I remember all of us were awake because we were doing it. I think we had a very short notice that time. The festival and the immersion ceremony was just 2 days or 1.5 days apart.
Most of the time, it's only 3 days apart.
Right. So this was a time when it was, we had to avoid Tuesday, which Swami said you should not do on a Tuesday. So we were doing it much earlier than we had anticipated. So we were all in a rush and the whole night we had not slept. So we came for the procession, the blessings were all over, we all went back, and after the immersion ceremony, we got word from the mandir that Swami is still not taken arti, he's waiting for all the boys to come back.
Okay.
So we all ran back to the mandir, and there Swami was at the portico waiting for all of us to come, and just standing there, and we were all around Swami, Swami gave a discourse for about half an hour on why sleep is very, very important. And he said how it rejuvenates the body and how the body is like a machine and what all happens when you sleep and how your mind calms and it gets ready for the next day. I mean, a very unique discourse because Swami is all the while speaking only about how sleep is very important for life. And of course, he also brought in about food. Swami spoke about food and sleep, how you should eat food. And Swami said, you're all young children, you do a lot of work, should eat a lot of food. No dieting and all that. Swami said you should eat well and you should sleep well. And then Swami gave us an instruction. I think it was around 5:30 or something in the evening. Swami said, after aarti, all of you go back. I'll tell the warden, dinner will be served immediately. Eat your dinner and go straight to sleep. So I remember going to sleep at 6:30 that evening. We all went back to the hostel. Dinner was served early. And 6:30 we all went to sleep. Because that was an instruction from Swami, imagine.
I remember an exactly similar situation even once during, I think, the first Gram Seva.
Okay.
When Swami had asked us to serve, I think you were also part of it, asked us to serve in Hindupur and Kadri. And it had been an extremely difficult day. And Swami wanted to introduce one more town. One more town, I think, before Hindupur.
Okay.
So Swami said, tomorrow, I want you to do Hindupur also, but it has been a very challenging day today. So go and sleep early. Tomorrow, you know, and exactly the same thing happened. Yeah, I understand the reason why you brought this up. Exactly, while sleep is called tamasic, it's a tamasic activity, it is not as if we can do without it. Tamasic, rajasic, sattvic, all three are necessary, and it is the interplay of these three gunas that make our day-to-day living. All three are important, but more important is when we do what.
Right.
In fact, yesterday I was reading scientifically, you know, they say when we sleep, the brain throughout the day keeps gathering inputs and it keeps having memories, you know. And it is apparently when we are asleep that the brain has free time because your eyes are shut. Your tongue is not tasting, your skin is not feeling, all your sense organs are shut, and it's an input free time for the brain. So it starts rearranging all your memories that it has collected through the day, and starts, it makes all the connections, everything. And you know, that's why one reason when you get up in the morning, you don't feel muddled, you feel very clear and good, because it's all been sorted out. In fact, that is being proposed as one of the reasons why we dream. Because the brain is going on rearranging memories and different memories flash across. And so it is not surprising that you see in your dream many things that you see during the day. And that is why, you know, the scientists say that when people tell you, you should sleep over a problem, it's actually very sound advice. When something is bothering you a lot, you just sleep over. The way the brain intelligently self-organizes things, by the time you get up, many times you'll have the solution ready.
I think it's something quite similar to what we do with our computers. We do something called defragmentation of the memory, right?
rearranging
the memory so that it frees up the memory. I think something's very similar to that.
And it boosts the functioning and working of the existing memory itself.
Right.
So that's what happens. So therefore, dear listeners, yes, though sleep is labeled as tamasic, it is not to anyway undermine its importance in our lives. We have to sleep. In fact, we had read about a CEO who died at a very young age of 44 due to a heart attack, which they say was caused due to sleep deprivation.
Oh.
He used to sleep only for 4 hours every day, but in all other sense, he had a very, very healthy lifestyle.
Right.
No fats, slim, well-built, well-built in the sense, yeah, he's muscular and he does yoga, he just drinks enough water, everything, only that he doesn't sleep enough and that triggered a heart attack. So, going back to our ceiling on desire satsang, there's nothing like good and bad in the world. Everything is good within limits, and beyond limits, everything becomes bad. Sleep more than the limit, it's bad. Sleep less than the limit, it's bad. Everything has its own proper time, place, a deshakala parisiti. And I feel Swami's thumb rule will be a good way to start off with. 4 to 8 in the morning, 4 to 8 in the evening, sattvic. 8 in the morning till 4 in the evening, rajasic. 8 at night till 4 in the morning, tamasic.
And coming back to the scene in this, on the banks of this river Tamasa, because when they wake up, that's what these people feel, that they have slept more than it was necessary for them to sleep. Because when they wake up that next morning, they find that the chariot, the prince, his wife and Lakshmana and the minister are missing. All of them are sleeping, but the scene is that the chariot is left. So then they start blaming each other that, you know, we are so lazy that we slept over it and, you know, we gave them the opportunity to slip away. In fact, it is because we were asleep. You know, Lord Rama being a very compassionate one, he didn't want to wake us up, he didn't want to disturb us, that's why he left. So they start, in introspection feeling bad about how they've, you know, given to the body's aches and the, you know, the tiredness the body was given to. But, you know, the way they, even this, you know, it's about 4 or 5 lines in the Ramakatha Swami, but the way Swami puts it, they say that we claim that he was our very life. But if it was true, how are we still living? And so nostalgic, this very statement which was made, because I remember 24th of April 2011, after Swami left all of us physically, this was a very question which one of the boys asked. Because that was the time when we were singing all the songs for Swami. And when this song, which Humko Tumse Pyar Kitna, was sung, there this very line comes. That, you know,
Dilo ki dhadkan tum ho sai.
He says, you are the water and we are the fish. And we cannot live without you.
Neeru leni chepa vedanam.
Right. And he said, that is the feeling we feel if you are not around us. And he said, you know, for years we sang this. Now Swami is not here. But we are still alive. Which means we have been lying all this while. And, you know, that's when one of the boys again joined, that which means if we are still alive, then Swami has not left us. You know, that was the first thing which struck my mind when this thing came, because that is exactly what is the summation of the discussion they come to. Because they say that we have left him, he has, you know, because,
in fact,
of our sleep, he has,
you know,
gone away.
Swami writes that the youth there, they say that what is the use of living? You know, they have not yet reached the ultimate conclusion that the alumni, the students reached, as you said. They are just feeling that Rama is the water, we are the fish. And if Rama is not there, we are supposed to die. So let us kill ourselves.
Right.
And they contemplate Atmahatya. Atmahatya is a Sanskrit term for suicide. It's so beautiful. Atma means self and Hatya means killing. Killing of the self. But, you know, it's so beautiful. Swami writes, I don't want to ruin the beauty by speaking. I'll just read out that statement. Swami says, why are we not bringing upon ourselves death, which will end sorrow? The people mourned. But soon they felt that since the Atma in them is Rama, the act of Atmahatya was unthinkable. So, Atma is Rama. So, killing yourself is equivalent to killing Rama, killing the Lord. And so, therefore, they said that the maximum we can do is pray to destiny to take us off. But it is not right that we take our own life. Again, I felt in such a beautiful manner, so succinctly and so quickly, Swami conveys that suicide is not justified in any context, in any this thing. Because Atmahatya is like killing Atma, and Atma is the Lord in us. Killing ourselves is equivalent to killing Swami. So that is, therefore, the citizens of Ayodhya dissuade each other from killing themselves, and that is when one of them, you know, suddenly jumps up and says, hey, look here, I can see chariot tracks. So they come upon this plan. They say, you know, it's so wonderful, let us now just follow the chariot tracks. It will lead us straight to where Rama is. And that is when they start following the chariot track and suddenly they see that the chariot is headed back towards Ayodhya. And they rejoice. They feel, wow, this is fantastic. Possibly Rama knows our heart's longings and desires and therefore he is headed back to Ayodhya. But then they see another track headed towards another direction. Then a third track headed in another direction. That is when they realize that the chariot by Sumantara has taken the chariot in multiple circles around that region. So now there is no way to make out which is the actual direction in which the chariot had gone. And that too, you know, at that moment feels very cruel and confusing, but in retrospect, it's an act of compassion because Rama knows that they will do their best to follow him and therefore this had to be done. And I feel this is a wisdom that we should also learn in life. Sometimes we also feel that our life is going in circles and confusing and nowhere. That also is an act of compassion and blessing by the Lord. And seeing this, the denizens of Ayodhya return back to Ayodhya crestfallen with a fervent prayer on their lips that within the next 2 or 3 days, Rama should return, Rama should return. That is the only prayer in their hearts, that is the only desire in their minds, that their Rama should return.
And here the royal couple and Lakshmana and Sumantra, they drive on. And as you said, from the shores of the banks of the river Tamas, they reach the river Ganges.
Yes.
And again, Swami beautifully describes the reverence which Lord Rama shows to the Ganges. The moment they come to the banks of Ganges, he gets down, he prostrates in front of the Ganga and he starts...
Swami says that it's at a town called Sringivera.
Right, Sringivera. And he starts describing the virtues of the river Ganga. He says that the entire land is prosperous because of her virtues, because of the prosperity that she brings. And in taking cue from Lord Rama, all the others to prostrate in front of the Ganges. And when this is happening, some of the boatmen who are there in the, you know, with their boats, they see this very weird sight because they see that there are three people dressed in the clothes of a mendicant, but they look like they are from a royal family. And of course, I'm sure Sumantra would have been in his royal attire. Minister's attire. So they're very surprised on seeing the scene, and they find that, so immediately they run into their city and they tell their chieftain that there's something like this, they saw a scene like this. So that is when he comes and enters this, you know, beautiful character of Guha. That's how Guha comes into the scene, and he comes, he sees Lord Rama, Lakshmana and Sita at the bank. And he approaches them.
Exactly. Just as Rama completes his ablutions, you know, again Swami makes a mention there of how Lakshmana goes and prepares a bathing ghat for Sita.
Right.
Because this is a jungle, this is a forest edge. The river banks are all slushy and muddy. And therefore Lakshmana goes a little ahead to a secluded spot where Sita can have privacy. And then puts rocks in such a manner so that her foot doesn't slip in the slush. And he prepares a bathing ghat where Sita can complete her ablutions. And in fact, the previous night, you know, we spoke of how everyone on the banks of river Tamasa slept soundly. Except for one, that is Lakshmana. I think this will be appropriate at this moment to say how Lakshmana, you know, it is dramatized in this manner that sleep is represented, you know, in our Sanatan Dharma, everything is represented by one god or a goddess.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have Lakshmi, who is a goddess of wealth. We have Saraswati, who is a goddess of education. We have Kubera, who is the lord of wealth. We have Indra, who is the lord of the rains. So like that. So Nidra is sleep. So there's a Nidra Devi. It is said that there is a goddess who is in charge of sleep. And it is in her embrace that we sleep every night, and she is the one who refreshes us. See, that is a beautiful way the Sanatana Dharma brings out everything as a blessing from God. The refreshing that we feel after we sleep and get up is a blessing of God on us, and that is a blessing of Nidra Devi. So the legend goes that as Nidra Devi approaches Lakshmana, he tells, "Mother, keep away from me. For the next 14 years, I will not be in the embrace of anything else other than that of seva of my Lord Rama." You know, we have seen how his wife has told him to forget even about her, and Lakshmana has even forgotten. She says, when I am not having a place in my mind or in my heart for a thought of Urmila Devi. Where can I think of Nidra Devi? So he says, Nidra Devi, don't come near me. And that is how it is said that throughout the 14 years of exile, where Rama, Sita and Lakshmana went through, Lakshmana did not sleep a wink because Nidra Devi had been told to keep away. In fact, you know, I'm sorry, Prem, I'm reminded, Swami mentions how during the coronation, apparently, you know, when the coronation of Rama was happening towards the end, Lakshmana gets a yawn. He yawns. And after he yawns, apparently he starts laughing loudly. And everybody in the court wonders what is happening. And the secret is revealed that Lakshmana had told Nidra Devi that you better not come near me for 14 years. And just as the 14 years concludes, when the grandest event of his life is happening, that is Rama and Sita being coronated and on a grand imperial throne in a royal darbar, at that moment Lakshmana is feeling sleepy and he is not able to contain himself from laughing at this paradoxical situation. So that is, I mean, that is a legend that goes, but that shows how devoted and full of service Lakshmana was.
Now, there is this, we've spoken about this before, apart from the story part of it and apart from all of them being characters, there is also this thing of, we see that, you know, the belief that Ramayana happens in each one of us and this is a journey of each individual, each Jivatma. So they would say that, you know, how can you be like Lakshmana? How can you be without sleep for 14 years? It is understood that you are in the service of the Lord, but how do you explain this 14 years of sleeplessness? And I remember, I think one of the spiritual speakers, he explains what it means when you say that Lakshmana did not sleep for 14 years. Of course, according to the story, Lakshmana did keep awake for 14 years. But when it comes to interpretation for following in daily life, he says Lakshmana never slept. He said when Lakshmana's body required sleep, it was given sleep. When Lakshmana's body required food, it was given food. You know, this is a very beautiful interpretation of it, because when we say, you know, especially when you told about the tamas being that 4 hours of the, I mean, 8 hours, the problem always comes when you indulge in something, you know, when your body wants more than it requires and you give it that. You know, when you say that 14 years, he just slept what was required for keeping this body going, he gave it that much sleep. You know, other than thinking of you going to sleep, you're saying that I'm giving you sleep. The way you put it, when you put it that way, it completely becomes like you're rationing what is required for you. This is the need, it will be given to you. And I think that is the way it has to be taken when you're looking at it from the point of view of sadhana. That you don't oversleep, the body asks for more sleep, you don't give it more sleep. This is all is required.
Exactly. And extrapolating that, it's not only for sleep, it's also for food.
Right.
We don't overeat. You know, most of us will be guilty of overeating sometime or the other because we fall prey to the desires of the tongue.
Right.
I remember Swami saying that when you do the Ceiling on Desires program, when it says don't waste food, it's not only about the food that you throw from your plate into the dustbin or you leave behind in your plate. The food that you overeat is also waste of food, because that is food that your body does not need. It will not be digested properly, it will be thrown out, or it will go and add to body fat, which is all a waste. So even overeating is a waste of food, and this is a very subtle angle which we often overlook. So when we practice Ceiling on Desires and we say that we don't want to waste food, it's not only about not wasting it but also refraining from overeating. And yeah, coming back to the story, so Guha is a chieftain, local chieftain, and he's very, very happy. He's the chieftain of the tribals there, and he's very happy because his might have probably been a small district or a small province in the entire kingdom of Ayodhya. And so he's very, very happy, and he's surprised because, you know, news has not yet traveled till here that what has happened, that the coronation has got cancelled. And in fact, that is why Guha is not even aware of who these people are.
Right.
When he gets to know who they are, he wonders why are they in such clothes. And that is when, you know, Rama updates him of all that has happened. Of course, the way Rama updates would be different from how you or me update, Prem. You or me would have just said that, you know what, this Kaikeyi, this lady, this is what she has done. But Rama just says that it is a command of my father. I have been told and it is for the welfare of everyone. So therefore, in order to uphold my father's word and this, we are all going. It's a beautiful thing that father has blessed us to visit all the, he puts it in a very positive light in that manner. But then Guha is unable to bear it. And when others in Guha's territory, they come to know of it, everybody is feeling bad. And again, Swami reproduces a nice conversation that happens there. There are some who are speaking very ill of Kaikeyi, saying, how could she do this? What a terrible woman she is. At the same time, there are some other wise people, Swami writes, they say that, no, don't speak like that. It is because Kaikeyi did this that today we are able to have the darshan of Ram, darshan of Rama in our midst. It is because of that that our eyes are able to feast on this banquet. It's a celebratory time here. Otherwise, where could we have ever dreamt of seeing our Rama? So, instead of cursing Kaikeyi, we should actually, offer our salutations and, blessings, send our wishes for her, because it is her, her act that has enabled us to have this darshan, so let us rejoice. I feel so beautiful it is if we are able to take everything in our life in that manner as a blessing from the Lord.
Very true. I think, I remember one of my classmates used to say, he was not the brightest in the class. He would often say that how he struggled through school and all that. And he would often tell this. He said, had I been really good at studies, I would have gone for engineering or medical. I would have missed this. So I'm grateful for not doing well at school. Of course, I'm not saying that to get into Swami's college is any easier. Those of us who have been through it, we know it is not at all an easy thing. The competition is as much as in any premier institute. But he was saying that had I been good, I wouldn't have even thought of, applying for a bachelor's in science.
Because generally a bachelor's in science is considered
kind of lower than engineering and medicine. I would have gone for becoming a doctor. Hmm. So he says, now looking back, I'm happy that I was not very interested in academics when I was in school. So I think it's, as you said, it's a beautiful example for us all in life, that everything which is negative will definitely have a positive to it, and we are just not looking at it in the right manner.
Correct. Guha now, sees the opportunity and he prays. He prays to Rama saying, Rama,
invites him to the city.
Yes, you have come thus far, why don't you come to the city? But then Rama again reminds him, he says, see, I am in exile now. It's not as if I am coming out of Ayodhya and then I enter some other city and start making merry. It's not like that. I am supposed to be in exile and therefore I can't enter the city. And that is when Guha prays. He says, then Lord, let your eyes just fall upon the city. If your eyes fall on the city, it's more than enough. And Rama is touched with his
devotion. I think he takes him to one of the cliffs or one of the elevated places. Hmm. And from there he shows the city and he says, Rama, that is our city. And so that, Rama's eyes could at least fall on that city of these fishermen and boatmen.
In fact, Swami mentioned that it was Simshupa tree. Simshupa tree.
Okay.
And that tree, I just checked on Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. It's a tree that is revered greatly by the Buddhists.
Okay.
And it is a variety of redwood tree that's found only in India.
Mm-hmm.
Not only, but mainly in India. So it's a redwood tree. So it is a huge Simshupa tree. To which Rama goes and from there casts his glance on the city. When I read that, I was reminded, Prem, of, I don't know if it's a philosophy or, just correct me if I'm wrong, but something like Kurma Kishora Nyaya.
Mm-hmm.
There are different Kishora Nyayas. There's one Markata Kishora Nyaya,
right.
One Marjara Kishora Nyaya. They say Marjara Kishora Nyaya is a relationship between the devotee and the Lord, where Marjara is a cat. So the devotee is complete in surrender, like the mother cat carries the kitten around,
mm-hmm.
The Lord carries the devotee around and the devotee needs to worry about nothing. The same teeth of the cat which can actually kill rats will now actually hold the kitten very tenderly. It's like something like Prahlada and Narasimha, I feel,
Right.
Narasimha, who tore apart Hiranyakashipu, was so tender with Prahlada. Then there's a Markata Kishora Nyaya where the little monkey holds on to the mother monkey. That is another relationship between the devotee and the Lord, where the devotee holds on to the Lord. And the Lord has faith in the devotee. The mother monkey never tries to cling on to the baby because she knows that the baby will not let go. So here, the devotee holds on to the Lord and the Lord has faith in the devotee. In that, there is also one more called the Kurma Kishora Nyaya, the way a mother tortoise takes care, mother turtle takes care of her little ones. She lays about 50-60 eggs on a beach and she goes off into the ocean. And you know how slow moving these are. As the little turtles hatch, it is said that the mother sits at a distance and keeps looking. And it is said that through her looks, she guides the little turtles into the ocean. And it is said that the avatar often does this. Through his looks, he is able to, you know, guide the devotees onto himself. And that is what we saw, right? It would happen in Kulwant Hall. Swami would just sit at one spot and just look. And in fact, Swami has mentioned in the power of darshan that anything that my eyes fall upon are transmuted and transformed. That was Kurma Kishora Nyaya that we would see. And that is what I felt happened here also, as Rama stood at a high spot and cast his glance over this whole region ruled by Guha.
And that is how he refuses the hospitality in the city. And we would see that even in future, even as, you know, that Vanvasa progresses, and when he meets Sugriva and later Vibhishana, how he refuses to step into the city completely. You know, I think this is what is self-discipline. You know, even when you're not bound under anybody to follow these things. But he decides that this is what I'm going to follow when I'm following the word of my father, and he sticks to it till the very end. So he refuses to go into the city. Now they have to stay for that night. So now Guhas makes arrangements for them to stay, you know, at the banks of Ganga itself. And that's when, again, he notices that after preparing the bed for Mother Sita and Rama, Lakshmana sits at the feet of Rama and starts massaging his feet till he goes to sleep. And again, you know, the way beautifully Swami says that Rama has not fallen asleep, but he feels that if he doesn't pretend as though he has fallen asleep, then Lakshmana will continue to sit there and pressing his feet. So Rama pretends to go to sleep, and Lakshmana thinks that if I keep pressing his feet now, I might disturb his sleep. So then Lakshmana gets up, and Swami says that he sits in one corner where Mother Sita and Rama are asleep. He goes and sits in one corner, and Swami says, in a hero's pose, and starts casting his glance in all the four directions. And, you know, sitting in vigil and ensuring that nothing happens.
And this is the time at which, you know, he's joined by Guha.
Right.
One can picture the scene, Rama pretending to be asleep so that Lakshmana can relax. But Lakshmana not letting go of his vigil so that Rama can have a sound sleep. It's so beautiful, where it's almost like each is living for the other. At that point in time, Guha comes in and he sits and he starts talking in whispers with Lakshmana. And you know, he is confiding and he is telling, you know, Lakshmana, Rama is used to the most great comforts. He is sleeping on silk and soft pillows, soft beds, and now, you know, he sleeping on such a kind of grass pillow and grass bed. What about Mother Sita? She is such, you know, a dainty princess who is as tender as a rosebud, and now she is sleeping in such a condition. His heart pains and aches in agony, and that agony gets transformed into anger towards Kaikeyi, and he also starts lashing out. Guha also lashes out, speaking of how cruel Kaikeyi is and how she is a big black mark on the whole kingdom of Ayodhya. And that is when, you know, surprisingly, because Lakshmana, we often know him as a quick trigger temper, but Lakshmana offers great words of wisdom and words of solace to Guha. He tells him, "Oh Shiftan, you know, one does not get happiness or sorrow through others. What happiness one has is one's own. What sorrow one has is one's own." And that is what Rama is showing, you know. Rama never was jubilant about him being crowned as the crown prince. At the same time, Rama is not miserable at what you consider as his plight today. And then, you know, Lakshmana goes on to speak about destiny. He says, each one comes for some purpose. Urged by the potentiality of his acts in a previous birth or some other older birth, definitely due to sovereign will and resolution. So it's divine will that all this is happening. When you go to sleep, you might be a beggar or you might be a king. But that doesn't affect you when you wake up, because you know that is mithya, it is illusory. That is exactly what brother is teaching, that this whole thing is mithya. It doesn't matter whether you are sitting as a crown prince there or sleeping here as a mendicant. So, you know, it is a beautiful satsang that the king of Nishadas, Guha, and Lakshmana have at the lotus feet of the Lord. A beautiful satsang to spend the night. And it's, that is how the night passes. And next day morning, Lord Sri Rama wakes up and apparently, you know, he acts as if he is well rested and he stretches his arms and the next day has begun.
You know, just going back to that scene of Lakshmana and Guha, one thing which strikes is, I think this is again a lesson. You know, Lakshmana himself has not reconciled with the fact that Lord Rama has to go on an exile. But in explaining to Guha, he is actually explaining to himself. Some of these things he might not have explained to himself, and that's why he is angry. I think this also happens to all of us, you know, when we are going through problems. But when we are in a situation where we have to console or explain to somebody else to take their problems in the right stride, I think that's when we actually end up giving a lot of consolation to ourselves.
Because, you know, as you rightly said, Prem, the next day morning, as soon as he wakes up before his ablutions, Rama apparently asks for the juice of the ficus tree.
Right.
I think ficus is the fig tree. And when the juice is brought, he applies that juice liberally over to his hair, and that is when he mats his hair. Because when you're in the jungle, you live, I mean, when you're in the forest, you live with matted hair, you don't have time to take care of your hair, you know. So he mats his hair, and seeing Rama matting his hair, something breaks from within Lakshmana, and he went out. It's unbelievable if you read the Ramkatha Rasavahini that it's not even like previous night, because when you read Ramkatha Rasavahini, you'll feel, Lakshmana, three paragraphs before you were, you know, giving words of wisdom. Right. What happened? Because Lakshmana says, Rama, I can't see this anymore. You know, this is horrible. This is terrible. This is a wretched thing. And, you know, Lakshmana gets into anger, fits of anger against Kaikeyi, and again, it is Rama who has to calm him down. So I think what you say is really holds good, that we are very good at giving wisdom, and when we are in need of wisdom, we need others. That is why, you know, it is so important that as people, you know, we live together as the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God. Our mother Sai is there, motherhood of God or fatherhood of God, as we wish to take it. We should all live united. We should, each one of us, live for the other, because like Lakshmana, we too are able to give consolation when others need it, but when we ourselves need it, our own wisdom doesn't help us. We need support from the others. And therefore, each one of us should strive to live for each other.
And one more thing probably one could do is, I've seen this working well personally and with others who have tried it out. When you're in a situation, talk to yourself like you're talking to a third person. Talk to yourself like you're talking to somebody, your friend who's in problem, and trying to console him. I think the clarity which comes out is sometimes surprising even to you.
And that also, you know, in a subtle manner reinforces that I am not this body.
Right.
Because I am talking to it as a third person. Just as you said, Lakshmana did not sleep, but he gave his body the amount of sleep it was needed.
Right.
So it helps us in identifying with who we truly are. So dear listeners, the time in our studios has just flown by. It is 1:56. In a few minutes from now, you will have Brother Chandu joining you for his segment Love to Love. And it is time for Prem and me to take leave. As always, we offer our grateful salutations to Hanuman, who is sitting by our side always and guiding when the sweet nectar story of Lord Rama is related or is described or is gone through. And we offer our grateful prostrations at the lotus feet of our dear Swami. We hope you have enjoyed this, Swami. And dear Swami, we know that you communicate and talk to us through all the devotees who write emails to us via the ID listener@radiosai.org. That is how we consider all the feedback, dear listeners. So you can definitely write to us with your feedback, your comments, your opinions, your thoughts. We would be delighted to go through them. Next week again, we will continue with this beautiful nectar story. So you can write to listener@radiosai.org. So right now we will play a song for you, on the other side of which you will be met by Brother Chandu. Till next week, it is Sai Ram, and happy listening from both Prem and myself.
दशरथ राम जानकी राम दशरथ राम जानकी राम मारुति सेवित मनोभिरा मारुति सेवित मनोभिरा सीताराम श्री रघुराम सीताराम श्री रघुराम पतिपुरीश्वर श्री साईरा जय जय राम जानकी राम जय जय राम जानकी राम अहल्योद्धारकानंद राम अहल्योद्धारकानंद राम दशरथ राम जानकी राम